All right, the cross-cultural classroom. I know that good titles, they say, are usually concise, but as I developed this workshop over the last while, there were times I didn't feel like this title encompassed the subject really well. It was a little bit, I told a couple of people, it's a little bit like being told to give a workshop on the solar system. And what do you do with that? Where do you start? Where do you end? And so I came up with an alternate title after a while that wasn't really meant to be a serious title, but I'll give it to you anyway. And that was The Cross-Cultural and Multidimensional Dynamically Changing Classroom. Like I said, that wasn't meant to be a serious title, but maybe it's one you relate to. Because our classrooms are dynamic, they are multidimensional, they are changing, and they have this mix of cultures. And these cultural dynamics of our classroom can be one of the more challenging parts of our teaching many times. And so what we specifically want to address in this workshop is not just to discuss the differences, we'll do that a little bit, this cross-culture, but most of all, I would like to talk about how we can create a wholesome classroom culture from out of the cross-culture that we have in every classroom. Maybe I should mention this too at the beginning, that when I was first assigned this workshop, of course, my mind immediately went to like ethnic cultural differences. And I was like, well, I don't actually have a lot of experience with that. But as I got into the subject, I began to realize that all of our classrooms are cross-cultural, and it doesn't have to do, sometimes it does, but it doesn't have to do with ethnic backgrounds many times. So the scope of this workshop, we're going to cover six common cultural differences that I think we find in almost every classroom. Then we'll talk about, I think it's five, what I will call key components to creating a wholesome classroom culture from out of that cross culture. And then we'll talk about, towards the end, there is a particular difference that many of us we'll face in the classroom at some point, a cultural difference that can be particularly troublesome to navigate. And I'll give some of my candid thoughts on that. And then if we have time at the end, which I think we will, we'll have some Q&A sharing discussion, hopefully. So areas of cultural differences, we'll roll through this fairly quickly. Like, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but one cultural difference that we find in almost every classroom is community differences. Young people who have moved in from other communities, and whether that's from east to west or west to east or just across the state, north to south, there are cultural differences that need to be acknowledged there. And sometimes some schools will even allow children from the local community to attend school as well. We actually do that in a limited way there in Seymour, Missouri, where I teach. So those are that's one cultural difference that we face. The next one is church backgrounds. Most schools, most churches have people that move in from other church communities, and those church communities have different cultures than our community. And maybe some churches have a culture of hospitality. Some may have a singing culture, a music culture. Others maybe just have a very laid back, relaxed culture about them. And sometimes, and this is, I think, more true maybe on the East Coast, where there's, you know, a lot of conservative Anabaptist people living in a group, there'll be a number of churches that work together to have a community school of some form. So those are some of the cultural differences we probably face. In the home, every set of parents, we'll talk more about this later, but every set of parents is going to bring their own particular culture via their students into the classroom. And so to acknowledge that. Some parents can be quick to voice their opinions about what should or should not happen in the classroom. There's others, and we love these types of parents. They just give us broad discretion. They don't say much, and they give us lots of support, right? They give us broad latitude with their children. The differences here are educational preferences that parents have. So some parents want to see their child go and get their diploma. Even if the school only goes through eighth grade, they're still going to push their students through to get their high school diploma. Where other parents, they will let their child decide at the end of eighth grade whether they're going to come back or not, which is, I think, is a terrible idea to put that decision on the child. All right, and the next one, bear with me, isn't technically a cultural difference, but it still is a part of the culture of the classroom, and that is gender differences. We're going to talk about this briefly at the end. Mainly, we're going to highlight the importance of just being aware and intentional about this particular thing. The next one, again, is not technically a cultural difference, but plays into the culture of the classroom, and that is individual personality. So you see how we're going here from broad to narrow. Personality is very widely. You have the serious student, you have the happy-go-lucky student, you have the melancholy student. We have students that are bright. We have students who struggle in school. Maybe we have some that actually have learning disabilities like dyslexia or ADHD or the alcohol syndrome that some have struggled with. Maybe we've even had those with mental handicaps in our classroom. Maybe you're coming in and not doing any of the curriculum in the classroom, but they're there for the social environment. I had a student like that for a number of years she was there simply for the social aspect. There was someone who did some tutoring for her. So those are some of the cultural differences. And then we do have the ethnic backgrounds that come into our classroom. I had a young man, I haven't had a whole lot of experience with this, but I did have one young man early on in my teaching whose family was originally from Romania. And English was his second language, and it was kind of a problem for him in school. He was quite the fellow. He wasn't really motivated about school at all. He struggled with his academic work because of the English being a second language, and he struggled with his temper. He struggled with his language. Like, I'm talking about bad language, all those sorts of things. But I kind of look at him as one of my first experiences really working and learning to love the struggling student. And for that, I really develop a really special place in my heart for him. And so when I see him today, I just love him to death and care a lot about him. So you take these differences, these six differences, and you mix them into a classroom. And in the classroom, we often have immature people, right? So you have cultural differences plus immaturity, and your job is to take that and make something of it, right? And that is what can be challenging. When we can take that and create a positive classroom culture out of it, that is very rewarding for us as teachers. But if you've taught for any amount of time, you know that this does not happen overnight, rarely. But it can be lost overnight. I found that out too. So you have to nurture it. You have to develop it over a period of years even. You have to be diligent with it. Maybe I'll just tell one quick story here that wasn't in my notes about the time it took to develop a piece of classroom culture. So the first year I taught, I, in my ignorance, allowed my students a lot of free time when they finished their work. And it took me years, literally years, to slowly whittle away at that until I could get it completely out of the classroom. So that's just an example of something taking a long time. So there are five key areas that I would like to promote today as being important to focus on in cultivating this positive classroom culture within our classrooms. There might be some other keys as well, but like we can't talk about the entire solar system, we have to be selective here. So the first one that I think is just so important, and this really goes so well with what Mervyn was sharing earlier this morning. I just feel like he did such a profound job of doing that. And that is capturing the heart of Christ for the children that are in our classroom. We know that Christ has a special place in his heart for children. We know it as adults. We learned it as children. We sang all those children's songs. Jesus loves me, this I know. Jesus loves the little children of the world. There's other songs as well. And if you look, there's a number of Bible passages that I'm going to quickly go over here where Jesus relates with children. The first one is from Mark 10. Then they brought little children to him that he might touch them. But the disciples rebuked those who brought them. But when Jesus saw it, he was greatly displeased and said to them, "Let the little children come to me and do not forbid them, for of such is the kingdom of God. Assuredly, I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will by no means enter it." And he took them up in his arms, laid his hands on them, and blessed them. And then there's another passage in Matthew 18 where the disciples were raising this question of who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus took a child and put this child in the middle of this group that he was teaching. And he told them that the greatest in the kingdom of heaven is the one that becomes like that little child, right? And then Jesus said this, "And whoso shall receive one such little child in my name shall receive me. But whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea." So here Christ is inferring that when we care for the children that are in our classroom, we are effectively caring for Christ as well. We're receiving Christ. And the warning that goes with it too, which is often what we think about here, that if we cause one of these little ones to stumble in our classroom or wherever, it'd be better for us to be drowned in the sea than to have that happen. Some of my favorite verses in the Bible, personally, are these from Psalms 103, familiar verses. "Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him, for he knoweth our frame, he remembereth that we are dust." When I became a father myself, I have two boys, these verses really, their meaning just grew so much. Because I look at my boys, and I don't know how many of you here are parents, but I look at my boys and sometimes I love them so deeply that you just can't quite describe it. And if you're a parent, you know what that feels like, I'm sure. And then I think, well, this is how God loves me in the same way. And that's really special. And then sometimes I'm inconsistent. Maybe I'm harsh with my children. And I remember that God isn't like that with me. And so I'm humbled by my own inconsistency then, right? So that has been really impactful for me. Here's another verse. "Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings hast thou ordained strength because of thine enemies, that thou mightest still the enemy and the avenger." These verses, and there's lots of other verses that speak into this, they just clearly show God's heart for children, Christ's heart for children. Instead of saying, "I have other things that I need to focus on," which is easy to do, God says, "Come to me," right? Instead of saying, "You're loud, you're annoying, please be quiet," which I do sometimes as a dad, God says, well, God blesses them, it says. Instead of saying, "You got yourself into that scrape, tough, get yourself out," God pities them. And finally, we have that last verse I read about the babes and sucklings stilling the enemy and the avenger. How is it that the most helpless little creatures on earth can somehow bring pause to the enemy, the great enemy. That's just a great mystery. These little ones, and I think specifically there it's talking about the babies, but somehow they bring praise to God that carries so much weight and strength. I think it's really beautiful. And then one more account that I really think is important with this discussion, and that is the account of the rich young ruler, where you see Christ interacting with a young man. We don't know how old he was, but I often picture him as a late teens type of person. And this is what these verses look like. Then Jesus, looking at him, loved him and said to him, "One thing you lack, go your way, sell whatever you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And come and take up the cross and follow me." And I think this kind of sums up this part here, this key element, that this is the invitation that Christ has for every young person, that they come to him and that he loved them. That's really what stuck out to me when I read this verse, is that Jesus looked at him, and what did he do first? He just loved him. And I think that's so beautiful and really should fuel the inspiration that we have in our classroom when we have all these cross cultures coming into our classroom. We should be inspired by that. We should be excited about that. That's what Jesus did. I had a young boy, and the story that Mervin shared just rang so well with me. But I had a young boy in my classroom who was really unmotivated. And it, frankly, it was to the point that I found it irritating to work with him and frustrating. And I had to use this as a tissue here. Excuse me. I had to pray for him quite a lot, and I know that sounds very righteous, but it was I was so frustrated. It's just like that's how I had to do it. It was the only way I could get past it. And over a period of time, one day everyone else went out to recess, and I asked him to stay in because he was behind on his work, and I decided that the time was right to have one of these heart-to-heart chats with this boy. And those types of conversations are not easy for me to have. And in fact, after the conversation, I went away and I didn't really feel like I had done a phenomenal job, or that God had given me some clear picture like he gave Mervin there. But I did tell him several things. And one of the first things I told him was that, I do actually care about you a lot, and I want you to succeed. And that I told him I've been praying for him, because I know that this has really been a struggle for him. And I told him about all the great potential that I believed he had, because this young man, his hobby is training horses. And I think you would be blown away with what he can do with horses. Like, he does a better job than anyone I know with working with horses. And so I told him about how well he does with that. And I just, I told him, if you would take that same excitement, that same passion that you have for working with horses, and bring it into something that maybe doesn't excite you so much, but is assigned to you, you could do so well. And that is so important for you to learn to channel your energy into other things as well. And when I finished that little conversation, he had tears in his eyes. And ever since that day, my relationship with that young boy has changed for a variety of reasons, I think. And it wasn't like it fixed him, his problems. Like, he still had moody days. He was still lazy some of the time, a lot of the time. But it changed me, I think, for one. It changed some of the ways that he viewed the classroom. He was a lot more open after that with me. In fact, soon after that, he brought me a painting he made, which wasn't something I even knew he could do, but it's a really cool painting. I wish, if I would have remembered, I would have put it up here on the board. But I really treasure that, because that's like the first sign I had that I was kind of getting through to him. And the thing that changed, I think, that was most impactful is that after that conversation I had with him, he began to understand that when I kept him in from recess or just told him, was straight with him about something that was going on that he was behind in, he realized that it wasn't because I was irritated at him, because I think that's how he felt before, but rather he understood that was because I actually did care for him. And that changed him so much, and it changed me as well having that conversation. So as we face these cultural differences in our classrooms, I think it's just so critically important that we develop this heart that Christ has for children, and just love the children in our classroom. Let that love infuse our actions in the classroom. I think the power of Christ's love can sometimes be underrated a little bit, like we sometimes can underrate the power of prayer. And I think the more that this just becomes a part of the leadership that we show in our classrooms, and we're seeking the heart of Christ here, I think a lot of the cultural differences and problems that we face would actually diminish quite a bit in our classroom, and they would be resolved just because of us seeking the heart of Christ here. And that's why I think this is such a key element. Love never faileth. And I think we could just stop the workshop and have said what we needed to say at this point. But the next key element here is capturing a vision. What is your vision for your classroom? It's a question I would like to pose. And I'm sure all of us have had the experiences where we've had an epiphany, this light bulb moment in our lives where something became suddenly clear to us in one way or another. And for me, that was the discovery of vision in my classroom. And capturing that vision has, I can hands down say, has been the most influential thing that has ever happened to me as a teacher. It gave me renewed energy. It gave me renewed commitment to teaching. It gave me renewed purpose. It gave me all those things. It allows me to think ahead years down the road about things that are important to me. And it also allows me to focus on things that are happening in my classroom today. It can shape some of the day-to-day decisions as well, many of the day-to-day decisions. And that's why I'm posing this as another key element of creating wholesome classroom culture out of the cross culture. So returning to that question, what is your vision for your classroom? I'll just say this. If I ask you, what is your vision? And you know, you should know, if you actually have vision, you know without a shadow of doubt, the second I said that, you know what your vision is. Like, you just know. You could write it down, no problem, right away. And I also emphasize your, because this vision might correspond with a vision, the school statement or the church's vision for the school. It very well might, and it probably should. But it needs to be your vision. You need to own it. You need to believe in it. You need to believe in it 100% for it to truly be vision here. So ask yourself this question as well. What is the primary purpose of my classroom? And I'm going to ask some questions here for you to think about. One is it primarily to create intelligent people? Is it primarily to create people who can communicate well? Is it primarily to create people who have good life skills, like money management skills or something like that? Is it primarily to create people who can have that can have social status in the local community, and the community respects those people, right? Is it to create Christians? Okay, and I think we would all agree that those first four I listed are not the primary purpose of what we're trying to do in the classroom. But I kind of believe as well that the last one, creating Christians, is not actually the primary purpose of our classroom either. I think it's a worthy aspiration. Don't get me wrong here. I hope that it can be one of the fruits of my classroom. But I don't think it's the primary purpose of the classroom, because if that was the primary purpose of the classroom, then for many of us it means that we failed. Because I've had students go out of my classroom who have not made a commitment. And so that would make me a failure if I somehow didn't create a Christian out of that young person. And you see, that's not even our job, right? It's God who does the saving, okay? And we nurture and point that direction, but it's God who does the saving. Sometimes we get that a little mixed up, I think. So for myself, my vision boils down to this, and this is my wording on it. The primary purpose for my classroom is to equip and inspire young people to be builders in Christ's kingdom. Or you might think of it as building kingdom builders. That's how I like to think of this. And when you have vision for your classroom, there's so many things that it begins to shape in your classroom out of the culture, out of the cross culture. One is academics. So it brings clarity to academics. It can give us clarity about the emphasis we put on different areas of the academics that we actually teach. So questions like, is it better to push every young person through Algebra 1? Because that's just the standard. That's just what we do. Or would it be better to actually have them redo a level of math? Okay. What's the best for them? What will make them, equip them the most? You see? Do we teach history? Because history is a bunch of interesting stories and facts. And if we learn it well, it'll give us the ability to talk knowledgeably with each other about other cultures and things like that. They can be fun to do. Or are we actually teaching history because that's a valuable resource that allows us to understand other people from other cultures and allows us to communicate and witness to those cultures? What about science? Do we teach science because we can do these cool science experiments and our students get really excited about that and they like school because of it and they like us because of it? Or is the primary reason we teach science because we want young people to appreciate the order that God has put into place in his creation, and how we can take care of it and how we have proper dominion over it, which is one of the first works that God assigned to man, right? What about language arts and English? Do we want people to see the children coming out of our classroom and admire those young people because they can write really well? Or is our primary reason for teaching English so that these young people are equipped to communicate encouragement and inspiration to other people? And what about critical thinking skills, maybe fallacies of logic that get studied? Do we teach that so young people can outsmart each other or win at debate or something like that? Or are we teaching those types of things so that when they go out into the world, that place of chaos like Mervyn mentioned, do we teach those things so that they can sort through all the misinformation that is just so prominent in today's society? So my argument is that having vision helps us to prioritize these things and make decisions about those each individual thing. Some subjects deserve more merit than others. Maybe it can allow us to put less energy into some subjects than others. And your list might look different than mine. I put high emphasis on math. Jody over here puts high emphasis on English, I know. And I that's perfectly fine. But I think you can kind of begin to let go of the idea that you have to teach every subject equally well. Behavior is another aspect that vision touches on. When we have a vision for cultivating young people for service in God's kingdom, it empowers us to speak into those shady gray areas that are not neither black or white. So we can address things like rude behavior, because rude behavior is not furthering the goal of building kingdom builders, right? It allows us to say, I made a mistake and I'm sorry about that, because we know that it's important for those young people to see how we handle making a mistake and how we can just apologize and move on. We can face difficult conversations like I had with that young boy, because we begin to understand that if I do not have this conversation with this person, I am missing a really crucial opportunity to get through to this young person. And it could be the difference between me putting a stumbling block in front of that child and by missing that opportunity, or by breaking through to him in some way. You see, it becomes really important. It'll also allows us to assert discipline to our students, and we can do it without remorse because we know that we're not acting out of our irritation, but rather we are acting out of a heart of love and out of a purpose for the student. And extracurricular activities. We like to have these as teachers, but having vision allows us to answer questions like, am I doing this extracurricular activity because I just want students to like me, or I want them to like school? Or am I doing it because it's deepening my relationship with that student, or that student with other students? You see? And that's where it becomes. And that's one of the great things about extracurricular activities. They do that. There's nothing wrong with extracurricular activities, but we need to sense the vision behind why we're doing that. It shouldn't be about them just liking us more, I don't think. So the list could go on: lunchtime, recess, cleaning. My point is just this: vision has tremendous power in creating positive classroom culture, and we need to use our energy with intention. Lead with vision from out of a heart of love. Lead with vision from out of a heart of love. The next one is respect for authority, which is getting talked about this week. I have two rules in my classroom. I call them my two rules to rule them all. And they both have to do with respect. And the first rule is respect authority. And students of different culture need to be taught to respect their common authority in the classroom. And as teachers, we have a lot of opportunities to speak into this area. First, we need to command respect in our classrooms. I talked about this last year in a workshop I had here. Commanding respect is different than demanding respect, if you can see the difference. There's a number of ways that we can kind of organically command respect in our classrooms. And here's just a few that I'm bringing back from the previous workshop. A professional approach to in our classroom will command respect. Being self-disciplined ourselves will command respect. Being kind and merciful will command respect. Being honest about our mistakes. Respecting our authority is a huge one here. And also respecting our students is big here. So we can command respect. Now, I said it does not work to demand respect from your students. It does not work very well. I think to some degree, you can demand them to respect the other authorities that are on the premise. So we can demand that they speak respectfully to and of other teachers. So basically we're just asking them to respect the other teachers there at school. I think we can do the same about how they talk about the school board or even church leaders. Those should all be talked about with respect at school. I had a girl in my classroom last year. She was in eighth grade. Actually, my whole eighth grade last year was made up of girls, which is really interesting. And several of them were just, they could really give it back and forth to each other and talk big. And I'm no master of teenage girl relationships, but I do know there was some drama that was going on from time to time. But there was one girl in particular, and she was a community girl. During a home economics class one day, one of the church ladies was teaching it. She was being just downright sassy and disrespectful to that home ec teacher. And that evening, I kind of found out what was going on. That evening before she went home, I had a quiet little chat with her, and I told her that what she had said and how she had said it was actually disrespectful to that teacher. And she just turned as white as a sheet. And she very emphatically said that I did not mean that disrespectfully. And I was like, this is such a teachable moment, because respect isn't just qualified by our intentions. Rather, it's qualified by our actions, right? And the words we actually speak. And I told her that. And I told her, you know, I absolutely believe you, that you didn't mean it disrespectfully. But all the same, it was disrespect to talk that way. And I thought she would just kind of rebel against the whole thing. I wasn't sure what to expect. But she really turned around and stopped that sassy talk. And she just applied herself the rest of the year in home ec class. It was really amazing. And I appreciated that so much. So whatever disrespect that we for authority that we see in our classrooms, I think we need to address it, confront it, call it out for what it is. I think that's important. The next rule in my classroom is respect each other. This kind of goes along with God's second commandment to love our neighbor as ourselves, right? And students need a lot of coaching in this area. I would say that this section here is a lot of what we call the shoe leather work of bringing cross culture and making something positive out of it. But students need some help in learning to love and respect each other sometimes. One thing here is that I think it's important to realize that liking each other and respecting each other are not the same thing. I had a lot of trouble this past year with a respect issue between the boys in my classroom. There was, particularly in my seventh grade, which interestingly was made up of almost all boys. And there was a lot of immaturity that was going on there. And I began to realize, you know, young boys can like each other, but still be really disrespectful to each other. And there can be name calling. There could be slapping, just what we'd call boyish behavior maybe. And it began to give me some clarity in this when I began to realize that this was primarily an issue of maturity and not an issue of ill will between them. It wasn't like they were bullying each other out of ill will. It was just immaturity. And the question is, how much of should we speak into this? Because we've all heard the statement, boys will be boys, right? And there's truth there, but I think sometimes we can kind of use that statement as a kind of a way to step out of the fray and just let them be boys. And I'm not sure if that's always the best thing. Kind of where I've come out personally on this is that school is what we call a formal disciplined environment, right? And so I think it's in our place as teachers to call our students to a level of respect that kind of fits that formal disciplined environment. And so that means while it might be perfectly normal for boys to be boys, and it is, it might be healthy in its own time and place, I'm not sure that at school is actually the best place for that rough and tumble behavior. So I think generally that type of behavior should be discouraged at school, recognizing that it's usually a maturity issue less than a ill will issue, though that can come up as well. The other thing that's helped me is realizing that some behaviors aren't wrong, but they're just rude. And I talk about this with my boys in particular. So think about belching, okay? Is that wrong? No, not really. But is it rude? Yeah, we'd all agree it's rude behavior. And so that can give you some clarity in deciding what's acceptable and what's not, especially when it comes to physical behavior among students. So here's some examples I thought of. What about arm wrestling? Is that rude behavior? No. Arm wrestling is not rude behavior. So perhaps in the right place, that's acceptable at school. What about slapping each other on the back? Well, usually among guys at least, I don't know how the ladies are, but that's a kind of congratulatory, friendly sort of thing. So I wouldn't call that rude either. So I would say it's acceptable. But what about slapping each other on the seat of the pants? See, that's where it becomes rude. And so I would say that's not acceptable behavior at school. And that doesn't clarify every situation. Some of these matters can be really challenging. Like what about the practical joke where somebody pulls the chair out from underneath somebody as they're sitting down? And everybody laughs, including the person who sits down. Does that make it acceptable? Like, where do you draw the line there? So here's some other considerations that I found helpful. One is, are students giving each other a hard time for something that student can't help? And I was thinking through that. I'm not really sure of a scenario where that would be acceptable, to give a student a hard time for something they can't help. So if their parents don't allow them to do something that other parents allow their children to do, and children are giving that child a hard time about that, I don't think that's acceptable. But beyond that, I think that's a teachable moment, because that's when we can, that's the shoe leather work, when we can speak into that and say, listen, let's respect, every parent has a different culture here, and we're going to respect each other and acknowledge that. See, that's a teachable moment. Maybe a student got put back a grade or put back a level in math or something like that, and students are giving that person a hard time. I don't think that's acceptable. Okay. In fact, in my school, I am a huge proponent, but I want to promote the idea that students can be in whatever level they need to be working at, and that to be perfectly normal, perfectly acceptable, and other students not give each other a hard time. And thankfully, that has become the culture in our school. I don't have a problem. I know it's already challenging. It's difficult for a person to accept the fact that they have to go back and repeat a level. It is. But if they can kind of do that, and others just, you know, don't really say anything or worry about it, that's how it should be, I think. Maybe they're being given a hard time because they're unathletic. Again, I don't think that's acceptable. Rather, and again, this is one of those teachable moments, when a more skilled person is giving a less skilled person a hard time athletically, you should tell that skilled person, listen, instead of giving that young person a hard time, why don't you take him out and give him some pointers? And that can be a positive experience. I do think there are times for students to give each other a hard time. We know that in our classrooms is positive peer pressure. So if a student went home, didn't study for the test, they were lazy, they came back to school, they bragged about how they didn't study for that test, they went camping instead, and other students give them a hard time because they made a bad grade because of it, I kind of like that. I call that positive peer pressure. Okay, respect for the opposite gender. Now, I know that in my experience, I know that I don't think this is an experience for everyone, but in my experience, segregation tends to be more often the default than just comfortable mixing between the genders. And I wondered why that is. Is it because it's just the easy thing for us as teachers just kind of allow that segregation to happen because it's safe and we're not going to get in trouble? Then nothing's going to happen, right? And so we just ignore it. And frankly, I'm not really a big fan of just letting something happen because it's just the easiest thing to do. This is a huge topic, and I struggled and grappled for a number of days on what to say here. And I finally decided that I'm not going to say much because it's just opening a can of worms to have a big discussion. So at the lunch table, we can have this conversation. But here's just a few things, and I need to keep moving. One is, I don't think we should encourage segregation in our classrooms by always pitting guys against girls, that sort of thing. Now, there's some times for that. I think we should encourage free conversation at lunchtime, at recess. Recess is a great time to facilitate that in a healthy sort of way. Teaching guys to be gentlemen, all that goes along with that, opening the doors for the ladies, that sort of thing, really important. Teaching the girls to be ladies and allowing the guys to open the doors for them, I think, is important. Also, pointing and speaking to the lies of modern society, so lies that go along with feminism, some of the transgender, homosexuality stuff that goes on in our culture, you have to be careful with that one, but I think there can be a time and place, in the older classrooms at least, to speak into that type of thing. And then, in the last part here, one cultural difference that almost all of us have faced as teachers, and that is navigating parent-teacher cultural differences. I had a parent ask me once to stop reading a book, and thankfully I'd already finished reading the book by the time they got around to asking me to do that. But the thing is, this parent had issue with other books that other teachers were reading as well. It wasn't just me. In fact, they went on to the next year, right before school started, they wrote a letter to every teacher asking them to only read books from conservative Anabaptist publishers, and they wanted to see a list of the books that teachers were going to read before school started. And you can clearly see that's an overstep, right? And so I took that letter to the board, and I was just like, okay, what do I do with this? And they discussed, and they came back to us teachers, and they said, listen, we hired you, we trust you, use your discretion in your book selection. We give you 100% support for whatever you choose. I mean, talk about board support. That was phenomenal. So when that parent asked me now about a book I'm reading, I just say, I'm reading this book, but I'm reading a adapted version. That kind of takes care of the problem. But because I don't read the romance parts many times, if there's a little romance mixed in or if there's bad language, which sometimes happens, like even the Scarlet Pimpernel has some bad language in there. Some tips here that I think can be helpful. One is pray for wisdom. We sometimes forsake this one for whatever reason. I think we should first attempt to resolve issues with parents directly. We should have a conversation. We should seek to understand. Maybe it doesn't mean that we have to agree with them in the end, but kind of learn where they're coming from and see why they believe what they do. And then involve the board as kind of a last resort. And there can be kind of a fine line here between when you should run to the board and when you shouldn't. But I think you first need to have the conversation with the parents. But the thing is, if you can solve issues directly with the board, I mean with the parents, before running to the board's trust and respect for you is going to grow as they see you handling those sorts of situations and you not dragging them into every mess. They're going to appreciate that. And you know what we call that? We call that earning brownie points. And sometimes you can use those brownie points, all right? It's like a bank account. So use your brownie points wisely. We can also choose our battles. I had another set of parents come to me at Christmas time and ask me not to sing We Wish You a Merry Christmas because of the connotations with the word Merry. And that was a really tough one for me because that's not our culture, really, to not sing that song. And anyway, I decided to go with it, and we sang We Wish You a Blessed Christmas instead. A little hard on my pride and a little hard on the students' prides. But that was just an example of me choosing my battle because in the long term, it wasn't that big of a deal. And it gave me a little bit of a brownie point with that parent, and that was the kind of parent that I needed some brownie points with, you see. And so choose your battles. So, in conclusion, first, bear the love of Christ. Cultivate vision and purpose for your classrooms. Guide students in respecting their authority. Clarify the boundaries of respect among friends. Promote healthy respect for the opposite gender, a discussion to be continued around the table. And deal with cross-cultural challenges with prayer and one-on-one communication. So that concludes the workshop.